Hey, I'm David Kern.
I'm Heidi White.
And I'm Sean Johnson.
And you are listening to Close Reads, a podcast for the incurable reader, on which we are discussing The Hobbit, J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. We're discussing your questions about The Hobbit. It's another Q&A episode. Today's also tax day, though, so I thought maybe we'd do 30 minutes on tax questions. How would you guys feel about that?
Yeah.
I know a lot about taxes. Ooh. So
1099s, W-2s.
Tax credits and insurance, something or others. And
yeah.
Investments, the stuff about investments and taxes. Hey, yeah, speaking of which, what do you think the tax implications were of Bilbo coming home with all that treasure? Did he get taxed?
I think he was cagey
on that
about how much he had so that he wouldn't have to pay any sort of taxes. Obviously,
is that
the Shire
what it
doesn't
was?
Have
okay,
taxes.
Maybe that's why they ostracized. You don't think
no,
so?
No, the Shire's a perfect place.
That's directly addressed in the harrowing of the Shire.
Oh, that's
scouring.
True. Yep, you put up ugly brick buildings and you start charging taxes, and that's when you know that the bad guys
That's
moved
when
in.
You know that you've been taken over by demonic oppression.
So there's no taxes at this point. Bilbo did not get taxed on treasure. Should you not get taxed then, like ethically speaking, on things you find?
Right.
I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
What about things you steal from dragons?
For sure, no taxing.
Doubly so.
Yeah.
No.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I'm glad we were able to solve that. We are, of course, here to answer your questions that are not tax related, presumably. Maybe there
we'll
was one that snuck in there. Before we get into that, though, just want to remind you about all kinds of other stuff we have going on. We have the Daily Poem. Thanks to Sean. Sean has continued that. Thanks for doing that, Sean. So if you want to add a brief little bit of poetry to your day, every day, except Saturdays and Sundays, then check out the Daily Poem. We also, of course, have our bonus episodes over at Close Reads HQ, where we are discussing Kristen Lovren's Daughter. We are pretty deep into that conversation now. We're on to book three here pretty soon. And we also have our mystery series, which we're about to discuss, Josephine Tay's The Franchise Affair. We're going to discuss that this week, and then that episode will go up very soon here in April. And last but not least, for those of you who are subscribers, we have our monthly poetry hour coming up on this Thursday. That is in 3 days. We are discussing a couple of spring-themed poems. So that's the business. Can't answer any more of your tax questions when it comes to businesses, but we can answer your Hobbit questions. And so we shall do that. Sean, Travis wants to know what's in his pocket. You have an answer?
I wish. It feels like cheating.
Yeah, it does.
I mean,
and maybe that...
Maybe he's got a pen in there. Maybe he's got a cell phone in there. If he's a true gentleman, he has a penknife of some sort, right? Balls in your court now, Travis.
Yeah, but I mean, that's assuming a lot. Yeah, exactly. what I want to know is why Travis doesn't know what's in his pocket.
Oh, fair enough.
Yeah.
This isn't riddle episode. This is question episode. So obviously he's wondering.
Right, exactly.
Maybe Travis is in a dark cave and he has been a little discombobulated by his recent adventures.
Or maybe Travis doesn't know the difference between a question and a riddle. I'm just, you know.
Sometimes there isn't one.
Thinking out loud here. Hey, Heidi.
Wow.
Anyone wants to know which format would best suit this book? Play, cartoon, or three-part miniseries? For real, though. How much do you think the movie adaptations of Middle Earth have impacted how we read and imagine The Hobbit, The Silmarillion, and The Lord of the Rings now? So you can answer the first part if you'd like. Play, cartoon, or three-part miniseries?
I think not a play. For sure not a play. It's really hard to bring fantasy to the stage.
Yeah.
I think maybe musical. The Hobbit, the musical? Ooh. I just kind of think everything is good as a musical, though. Like, if you can turn Mean Girls into a musical, I think you can kind of do anything.
Did you see that? Aren't they doing The Lord of the Rings, the opera or the musical or something? They're doing it on stage?
I don't know.
I mean, if it was a sweeping Wagnerian epic, I could maybe get behind that.
I definitely can think not a play, though, because a play and a musical are two completely different things.
It's true.
Yeah, that's right.
No,
it needs to be an opera, Lord of the Rings cycle.
I remember The Hobbit as a as a cartoon from when I was a child.
Oh, the 70s?
Yeah. And I know that there are diehard fans who love that cartoon, and I respect that. But I do think it kind of degraded the world, the imaginary, the imaginative world in my imagination.
Yeah.
I realize I just used
that's fair. That
simultaneously. I shouldn't have used that word twice in one sentence. But I do feel like it kind of did destroy my imaginary experience with the world, although I do remember the song Frodo of the Nine Fingers. Remember that. So
where there's a whip, there's a way.
I just am real cautious about cartoon adaptations of literature.
Yeah, me too. That's a good rule of thumb.
Yeah.
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Yeah.
Well, what about the Wishbone adaptations of literature?
Well, that's not a cartoon, and it's a totally different story.
Well, Wishbone's fine. As long as there's a little dog playing Bilbo,
as long as there's a dog that has speech dubbed over, it's fine.
Okay, so for real though, is exactly what Amy said. How much do you think the movie adaptations of Middle Earth have impacted how we read these stories? What do you think?
I think a lot. And I realize that I'm going to get angry hate mail from Brandon LeBlanc right now. And I don't think he's going to mind being called out for this. But don't think that The Lord of the Rings, with the flaws that I freely concede, I do not think that the movies have degraded or destroyed our imaginative experience with the books. I really think that they have enhanced it, at least for me, even in the areas that I think, you know, they didn't get Faramir right. Yes, check. I accept that. But the casting was good. I still have a high reverence for his wisdom, right? And so I think that there's a couple of mistakes that are real big in those adaptations, but you can feel Peter Jackson's reverence for the books. And that I think that the world building and like the coming to life, he really honored that in the movies. And so that I don't think that they have ruined anything for this generation of Lord of the Rings lovers. I'm a little bit more forgiving in general, though. Like I'm kind of like, well, we are resilient humans. Even our imaginations are resilient.
I'm inclined to agree with you. Yeah. I think, but not. Well, yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you because I think the things that the movies did well, they did well.
Right.
Right. There is this effect of being transported to those places in a way that seems faithful. There's a lot of the spirit of the movies that seems really faithful. And then the things that are just crazy, bizarre, insane departures are so bizarrely insane that you can't be confused about them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you have a love for the high nobility of the characters in the books, the strange egalitarianism that's shot through all of the characters in the movies isn't going to like take over. Oh, but no, actually, the real Aragorn is, you know, a reluctant and pouty hero. Don't you guys remember from the movies? Like, nobody's saying that.
Yeah.
Well, someone probably is.
Well, there's
probably someone somewhere saying
Peter Jackson is, but it's fine.
Okay, moving on to the next question here. Let's do this one from Ethan. What are your thoughts on the sub/alternate title? And what about Hobbit culture as it relates to Bilbo's adventure? Bilbo is a bit of an outcast in the community after his adventure. He no longer has predictable opinions and habits and is therefore a bit of an oddball. There's so much wonderful veneration for the simplicity and quotidian life of hobbits in the book. Yet the one hobbit in this book who strays from simplicity is no longer as welcome. So thoughts on this, Hobbit culture as relates to Bilbo's adventure. Sean, you go first on this one.
Thoughts on Hobbit culture. I mean, I think that there's a real tension there. Maybe that Tolkien is saying something about, but also enjoying between being a man of the world and also appreciating these quiet comforts of the Shire. And it's really only the person who has seen the rest of the world that can be truly and utterly grateful for the peace of the Shire. And I don't think that there's a remedy for that. You also can't turn every hobbit into a metropolitan man of the world and still have the Shire be the Shire. And I think Tolkien knows that as well. So it's maybe a brief and disappointing comment, but I think that's what's going on there.
I think it's integral to maybe not integral to this book. It's integral to Lord of the Rings.
For sure.
I think for me, it's one of the most beloved parts of the story. I really love that sense of the Shire is a world in itself. It's a complete world in itself, but it's incomplete in the sense that it doesn't have room for the full complexity of life beyond it. And that's what makes it the Shire, to your point. That's what makes it a haven. And it's a haven of the quotidian things, the mundane beauty of life. And the mundane beauty of life does not have a place for the complex, jagged brokenness of the darkness of evil. And that's as it should be. It is an escape from it, a haven from it. It is a culture that exists to protect itself from that. And so the hobbits who venture out from the Shire and experience that weight of darkness, and it leaves a lasting impact on them. For Frodo, it's a physical wound, right? And it is from Weathertop, and it's the wound that cannot heal until he gets beyond this world. And that's a very Christian thing. Like, that's not despair. That's just reality. There is a wound that will only, in each of our souls, that will only heal in the kingdom of God. So even for Bilbo, it's a children's story, and so it's less weighty, but there is a sense in which he has experienced something that Shire doesn't have room for. It doesn't understand. And therefore he's always, as the comment says, he's always a bit of an oddball. He's not this kind of exile the way Frodo is, with this sadness, this grief, but he is just kind of a weirdo. And I think that that's as it should be in order for the Shire to remain an intact world in itself, which is going to have foibles and faults and frailties, as well as having this beauty and this mundane, this goodness and this kind of bedrock of mundane virtues. And Tolkien, as you said last week, Sean, you recalled to mind something that Tolkien didn't want necessarily to be an interpretive key, but I think still remains so, whether he wanted it to be or not, is his experience in the war. And in going out to war and coming back, he had that experience, and many combat veterans have that even today, which is why this story remains so beloved amongst people who have suffered, is that this world acknowledges Middle Earth and its creator acknowledge that there is a change that happens through adventure or through a quest, that the kind of mundane reality of life doesn't really have room for. And we always remain a little bit of an exile from that. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And good.
Yeah. And Bilbo is kind of a whimsical version of that. And Frodo later is a much more serious contemplation of that.
Right.
So comment here from Russell on the thread, who says, I know it's cliche to talk about Tolkien's writing in the context of his World War I experiences, but I wonder how much of the sense of alienation and almost anathematization Bilbo experiences is a mirror of what Tolkien himself may have went through at war's end. He's most comfortable in the presence of others who could relate to his experiences. It mirrors what many returning vets to more recent conflicts say their experiences, myself included, Russell says. And while I don't know enough of Tolkien's homecoming, it would not surprise me if he had that in mind. So I just wanted to add that in there. It's not a question, but
you can't leave. Literally what I just said. So thank you, Russell.
I was just adding.
Yeah, that's a great addition.
Adding Russell's comments in there. You can't go anywhere like that and come back the same person. The people who are there can't.
And we ought to be frank about that, right? Like, we ought to have that as part of our stories. And I respect Tolkien for that.
Sarah says, I'm teaching The Hobbit soon to seventh graders. Any suggestions? Heidi, you go first on this one.
I think with seventh graders and The Hobbit, I would really try to let the story speak for itself. Like, don't bring some of these complex things that we've been talking about on the podcast. Let that awareness dawn in them over time. Just let it be a story that they can delight in. I think one of the common mistakes that many middle school teachers make, in my experience as a classical educator, this actually happens in my school all the time, and has happened to me in my early years of being a teacher, is that we're so eager to have these rich discussions that we can have as adults, that we kind of superimpose them on our students way too young. And so The Hobbit, I would just let it be a delightful story and stay away from some of these more abstract discussions that we've had on the podcast. I would focus a lot on asking, I think with middle schoolers, when I approach like doing a lesson plan for middle schoolers on a book like this, I'm thinking, what kinds of questions developmentally do I want to train them to ask about a book that I could put in their heads? So something like, what virtues does Gandalf display in this particular scene or chapter or whatever? What is there to admire about the dwarves in this battle? And what is their, like, what vices do they demonstrate? Things like that. I want them to be asking those kinds of questions. Look up something like the 5 common topics. If you're not familiar with that, look that up on the internet. Those are Aristotle's points of discussion to frame a discussion. They're really useful for all stages, but especially for a book like this. And I'm going to stop there. I have lots of ideas on this, but I don't want this to become necessarily a pedagogical lecture. But I would say go for the 5 common topics, stick with the concrete embodied within the story, and stay away from the abstract. Sean, what to add to that?
As soon as I heard this question, the phrase that came to my head was, let it be a story. So I'm so glad you said that. That was excellent. Yeah. Let The Hobbit be a story. Enjoy it as a story. If you want to ask questions that get them to make connections, don't go broad and, you know, philosophical. Go down, if anything. Like, ask them if The Hobbit reminds them of fairy tales or, you know, other, you know, tropes in
or just what other stories does it remind you of?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what does this remind you of? What does he do you think Tolkien read these books? Right. And then I would also pay attention to concrete details in the story and ask ethical virtue questions. Was Thorin a good leader? Was Bilbo right to hide the ring from the dwarves? And why do you think he did that?
Right. And then just let their answers stand.
Live within the world of the story.
Like, let them stand.
Yeah, let their answers stand. Yeah.
And don't call them questions on ethics.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, don't call them questions on ethics. Don't say the word ethics.
Right. And I would have them do art projects with it, for sure.
Hobbit Hat Day.
Yes.
Someone should have Hobbit Hat Day.
David.
Yeah, Hobbit Hat Day is a great idea. I mean, as with any, if you want to be good at discussing any kind of art, the first thing you have to do is observe it. You have to see what's there. And I don't think that it's the worst thing to, you know, have them read it and then like have them start observing stuff and have them ask questions, then use those to spring off, like to spring forward from, to spring off of. I think kids tend to ask, when we just let them ask any questions they have, they might ask 9 silly ones, but there's usually one good one in there, like really good one in there that leads you pretty deep. Not always, but you know, if you're halfway decent as a teacher, you can probably like take what they're already thinking about and go pretty deep with that. But then you can often go from those into those ethical or virtue oriented questions pretty easily, because that's kind of stuff sort of always on kids' minds. Like, they're probably like half judging Bilbo all the time anyway. Well, like when he takes the ring. And talking about whether Bilbo should have taken the ring is like a pretty, or like how he took the ring, or get their opinions on that. That's a pretty good place to go.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's do this one from Aaron. If you were getting together with the Inklings at the Eagle and Child, or the Bird and the Baby, as they called it, what would you be drinking? Sean, you're first. What would you be drinking with Tolkien, Lewis, Charles Williams, Owen Barfield, Dorothy Sayers, should she be around and willing to stoop to their level.
Man. Yeah.
And whoever else happens to be
100%, I'd be drinking a pint of extra special bitter.
Whatever's like, whatever's the pub's thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my answer too.
Yeah.
Not drinking Guinness?
No. Not in Oxford.
Although, is it, are we talking, is it the bird, is it the eagle and the child when they were living, or are they here with us and the eagle and the child when we're living?
Because I feel like,
you know, so we're in their time. Yeah, yeah. All right. So you got your tweeds on and your,
Sean is already there. Like this man, he already looks like he's heading to discuss.
Man, God willing. Things.
Yeah. It's one of the things I just like most about Sean is he already looks like an old man, but he's the youngest of all of us. He's dapper. It's dapper. You should know. It's dapper.
Yeah. That's right.
Dapper Sean.
Yep.
Here's one from Melissa. Although, is this a question? Oh. The differences between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, I always accounted to the further development of Middle-earth by Tolkien. One seems focused on the under 12 crowd, while the other seems directed to the adult audience, fleshing out from concept to fruition, possibly added in concert with the aging of his own children. Yeah, that's not a question. So I'm not sure. You can think, you can agree or disagree. Okay.
I mean,
Heidi, Luke asks. Thanks, Sean. Luke says, you mentioned some similarities between Thorin and Achilles. What are your thoughts about parallels between Odysseus and Bilbo? And Heidi, we know how you feel about Odysseus. So I'm going to let you take that one first.
Yes, I do. Love me some Odysseus. I think that there are parallels in the sense that they are on a journey and that they have to overcome many odds. But the profound, there's a couple of really important differences that make it, I think, harder to compare. First of all, Odysseus is not on a quest. He's on a homecoming journey, and that's a very different thing. And Odysseus, there's some, I want to say some debate, but what I'm about to say, debate rages. It's not just like a mild debate. Well, one of the big questions of the Odyssey is, does Odysseus change? Does he undergo character development? You can absolutely make a case that Odysseus undergoes character development, but that would not have been the ancient reception of him was as a full and complete hero in himself. And Bilbo, the whole foundation of Bilbo's character is that he must change in order to complete this quest. And so he's on a very different journey. And Odysseus's journey is not comic. There's some moments of dark humor in the Odyssey, but it is not comic in the sense that it's funny. It's comic in the sense that it has a happy ending. And so in the true literary sense of a comedy, yeah. But it's not funny. It's not, it doesn't have this like kind of sense of lighthearted delight. I think a more apt character comparison with Odysseus is probably the closest you're going to come to is Aragorn. And there's some important differences even there, but there's still a weight of gravitas that Bilbo does not have that Odysseus must have in order to read the Odyssey. You cannot read him as a comic character and read the Odyssey correctly. And so I think that that's a really important difference as well. Sean, what would you add to that?
I think that's excellent. I would only add to that Odysseus has duties and commitments that call him home.
Right.
Bilbo has a longing for home, a nostalgia, but he doesn't have the same sorts of duties and commitments. There's no wife or son waiting for him at home. So his duties toward home are very different. Mm-hmm. But he is wandering and traveling. But yeah, I think the quest distinction is really important. And then I would say the duties driving him are different.
Side note, that would be an interesting question to ask students that have read the Odyssey.
That's right.
I want to take a quick break here in the questions, and I'm going to read a couple of the answers that were sent in about why kids like The Hobbit, which I mentioned that we would discuss. So I just want to share a couple things because they're delightful. So Mary posted on the comment thread for the last episode, my daughter Vera, who's 11 years old, said that the world itself is what draws her most to The Hobbit. She said that it's so different than any other place she has read about yet. The dwarves, elves, hobbits, etc. That's so interesting. She also loves that the story goes through many moods, adventure, humor, suspense, fear. It's a great point. Jack, who's 7, said he just loves Bilbo. And Goldie, who's 3, loves dwarves. As a mom, Mara says, maybe I said Mary earlier, it's Mara. As a mom, I think the speed that Tolkien goes from moment to moment in the plot is really helpful at keeping the kids' attention in such a vivid world. The humor, the humanity of Bilbo that we can all sympathize with, his smallness in a big world, and the narrator's asides to the readers all make the book very engaging for little ones and to me too. Okay, Ashley says, my kids all love The Hobbit. We read it last year and we are now listening to Andy Serkis's narration, which we are all truly enjoying. I love hearing them say, play The Hobbit, play The Hobbit. I asked them what they enjoyed most about The Hobbit, and my 9-year-old son quickly answered, it's the adventure. And my 5-year-old twins quickly parroted their older brother's answer, and one added spiders and the dragon. So I don't know if Heidi agrees with them, but the adventure part, I'm sure you do, Heidi. Not just not spiders.
That's right.
Unless you've changed... Yeah, you haven't... Have you had changed your tone on spiders?
I have not changed my tune on spiders. That is terrifying. And it just... I don't know. Which is scarier? Like the spiders in The Hobbit or Shelob even, like that's horrifying, right? But like to be surrounded by a nest of spiders.
It's not great. Mm.
Ugh.
Yeah, that is definitely not great. Jen says, I asked my college age daughter if she could recall what her favorite part of The Hobbit was when she was little. She answered that the part with Gollum and the riddles was crystal clear in her head. I said it was probably because that's my mom's least favorite part after watching the cartoon version with me in the 70s. My knitting bag has smog on it, says Jen. And my daycare kids, infants to 5, usually with the majority in the 2 to 3 year range, always want me to tell them about the dragon. Some really take to a quick explanation and want more. Others say, okay, and they're done. My cousin's son kept asking me, so I started reading it with him at 4 years old, but we didn't get very far between babies needing tending. So I gave him a picture book of Tolkien for Christmas and hopefully we'll get into it one day. Krista says, when asked why they love The Hobbit, my 15-year-old boy said that it's a good story, it has depth, and it has a way of making you feel like you're a part of the story. My 17-year-old son, she says, specified that he likes that there are multiple storylines and side stories and that it's in its own world. Christy says, my 15-year-old says she likes the world Tolkien created and that the story is so deep and yet accessible to everyone. 6-year-old likes the adventures and the battles, and the 9-year-old says it's fun, and she likes that it's long, so it takes a while to listen to. Rachel's 12-year-old says the character development of Bilbo and how the characters have to use their own knowledge to solve problems rather than just magic, which I guess maybe goes back to why we talked about Gandalf disappearing. 9-year-old says the fantasy world, the funny dwarves and all the battles. I'm noticing a theme about dwarves. The 7-year-old says when they're all really stupid and keep getting kidnapped, which I like. And the 4-year-old says when the hobbit falls into the hole and finds the rabbit and steals the ring. I think Gollum is the rabbit in that scenario. So we've got some, let's see.
I love that Gollum is a rabbit. And
that's great. Imagine Alice in Wonderland blending going.
That's so great.
Yeah, right, yeah. So Claire has 4 kids and the 12-year-old says likes the adventure and the characters. The 10-year-old likes how he has a ring. It's a secret power, but it's not a superpower. Mariah likes Gollum's voice. Now, is that the mom's voice reading it? Is that Andy Serkis? Or is she talking about voice in narrative? Noah likes that Bilbo is kind of brave, which is a great way of putting it. Bilbo is kind of brave.
That's perfect.
And he gets there. Right. And then Rena, I like everything because it's like cool to think of all the parts. So some good answers there from kids who have been listening. So with that, we're going to get back to some questions. Okay, speaking of voice, here's one from Rachel. If There and Back Again is supposed to be Bilbo's journey written by himself, why isn't The Hobbit written with Bilbo being the narrator's voice? I was thinking about this. We never really get the book. We just know that he's writing a book. We don't get that book, and we don't ever really get told who our narrator is, despite his detailed knowledge of the incidents of the story. Sean, what do you think about this choice by Tolkien?
Will you read the question one more time?
If There and Back Again is supposed to be Bilbo's journey written by himself, why isn't The Hobbit written with Bilbo being the narrator's voice?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's very possible it's very possible that Tolkien didn't know how much he would care for Bilbo or how significant Bilbo would be when he set out to write The Hobbit. Obviously, right, The Lord of the Rings is a development out of The Hobbit in many ways, and also out of the other, you know, myth making that he was doing. And we're not meant to believe that The Hobbit is the book that Bilbo wrote, but that Bilbo is writing a book about the experience that takes place in The Hobbit, which is a weird, you know, pedantic distinction. But there you have it. So it could just be that but by the time Tolkien had that idea, The Hobbit was already in the can, as they say.
I agree with that. And I think that pedantic difference is a real difference. Like, it's a real distinction that's important. We're not reading There and Back Again.
I think you can be more sympathetic toward Bilbo the way that the story is told. I think that there would be things about Bilbo's own character that wouldn't let him, like, a humility would come across if Bilbo was the narrator that would hide perhaps certain aspects of his character that we actually admire, but that he wouldn't tell us about. And I think that some of the moral dilemmas would also be smoothed over in Bilbo's telling, right? In the story, he actually does smooth over several moral dilemmas as he recounts his experiences to the dwarves. So I think those are probably good reasons that Tolkien might have consciously made that choice.
How do you froze? Were you going to say something else?
Yeah, I just think that these stories, the only way that they are as good as they are is with an omniscient narrator. Like, this is not something to, like, these aren't stories to, like, experiment with. Also, Tolkien was actively standing against the like, capital M modern literature in writing this. He wasn't interested in experimental narrative voice. He was just telling a great story from an omniscient perspective. And to your point, Sean, I think that's the only way that these stories are too complex and too comprehensive to have anything other than an omniscient narrator, third person narrator, who sees everything and knows everything. Mm-hmm.
Huh.
I'm waiting for David.
Well, I just don't. I mean, like, Jane Eyre was written in the first person, right?
It's a different story.
And that's not, like,
it's a story about a self. I know, but the development of a self. This is the story. This is a plot-driven story that has, like, so the narrator has to be in so many places at once, seeing so many things from a bird's eye view. I just don't think the only other way you could do it is with, like, the George R.R. Martin. When you have multiple narrators who are characters in the story, and I just think that would diminish the story.
In and out of.
Man, mentioning George R. R. Martin diminishes the story.
Exactly.
Boom, roasted.
I totally agree.
we could actually talk about this question of voice and talking for a long time, because I actually think it's the biggest weakness of The Lord of the Rings.
Oh boy. Never mind. Conversation.
We'd have to spend a whole. Is it the biggest weakness? It might be, in my opinion, because I think that I don't think that it makes it. I don't think that first person POV is experimental, so I'd take issue with that particular phrasing of that. I think, Heidi.
Well, but that's not exactly not what I said, that, though. Like, what I said was he wasn't interested in any kind of experimental narrative technique. He just picked the most. I get why you would say that. It's not experimental. It's as old as the novel. It actually precedes third person in terms of how novels are written. They were epistolary and first person before they were third person for the most part. So that is true.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really the only part that I would take issue with is that he would be experimenting, that he probably resisted it because of experimentation. I do think I do think that there is a case to be made. Well, I don't talk about it right now. We will write an essay on that one day and send it into the Lord of the Rings Journal.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would be more surprising for Tolkien to choose a first-person narrator in The Lord of the Rings even than in The Hobbit because of what he imagines himself doing in terms of genre.
Mm-hmm.
It's far more like an epic saga or a work of mythology. And there you're hard-pressed to find first-person narration.
Okay, so let me clarify. From an ideas perspective, it's not... it's not a weakness in The Lord of the Rings. Like he makes the choice that suits the ideas and themes he wants to explore. But I think it's where he runs into trouble from just a narrative storytelling perspective. Mm. But I generally, I even he could have even done a more third person limited. I mean, there's all kinds of things. I think a truly omniscient narrator actually tends to back authors into a corner that can sometimes be. Create a distance between the reader and the author. And the funny thing is, in The Hobbit, it's not truly, he's omniscient, but there's also like a character that's telling the story because he has a personality and we just don't know who he is exactly. Like it's just, I guess it's just Tolkien. That's very common in children's books. But okay, so Rosie wants to know, why are all the dwarves along for the ride? I mean, I always assumed this was mainly Thorin's passion project and Fili and Kili are his cousins, so they make sense. But why are the other 10 dwarves invited by Thorin, especially Bamba? Also on a narrative level, most of the dwarves don't talk or contribute. I think that might have been...
Oh, you mean what's his name?
Most of the dwarves
face?
Don't talk or contribute to the story. Was Tolkien just aiming for the 13 is an unlucky number thing, or is there a point to it being such a large group?
I do not know the answer to this question. I have wondered this from the minute I picked up the book. Why are there so many dwarves? I have absolutely no idea. And that is my answer.
Yeah, I mean, I wish that I knew. There are 12 dwarves, right?
I think that's right. Because then Gandalf and Bilbo make 14 when they go to visit Beorn.
Tolkien has been accused before of basing the dwarves on the Jews. I don't know how much that there is, but there might be a little bit there. In which case, 12 is a significant number, a number that they themselves might find significant, even. I think I don't know why the particular number is important. I have wondered before how the story would feel different or how the stakes would feel different if there were a smaller group.
Mm-hmm.
Like how small could you make that group before the story actually begins to change? Right? You think 12 or 13 people, maybe they've got a shot against a dragon. I don't know what fighting a dragon looks like practically in this world, but maybe 13 people, you could sort of forgive them for not having a hard and fast plan before they get there. But 3 people, obviously they have no chance against a dragon. So that those stakes change. So a large group is important for those sorts of structural reasons, but I don't know beyond that.
That sounds not like the 12 of them fought the dragon. That's how they won.
It's true, but I mean, in terms of expectation leading up to the climax of the book, I think maybe your fears and anticipations are different.
So Jeremiah wants to know, of all the 10 dwarves that survived the Battle of the Five Armies, why did Tolkien choose Glowin in particular to be the father of Gimli in The Lord of the Rings? And what was it about Balin that destined him specially... that destined specially to him to lead the expedition to reclaim Moria, resulting to his death and entombment there? I mean, maybe we just say I don't know again. It's just, you know, who knows?
I am not up on like completely up on my Tolkien lore. Yeah.
Gimli starts with a G and Glowin starts with a G.
Fair. Fair.
I mean, Balin, the second half makes more sense. Balin was sort of the senior member there. But the kingship went somewhere else, and so he strikes out to make his own name and fortune. I guess that could make sense. He doesn't seem like a particularly ambitious guy. when you meet him in The Hobbit, but things change. Maybe he had a falling out with Dane.
See all that treasure. There is a book called, well, as we said earlier, you can't go on a journey like that and not come back changed, even if you're a dwarf. So, you know,
even if,
there is a recent book came out called The History of the Hobbit, which is the text of the Hobbit alongside all kinds of information on the writing of the story. And I imagine in there somewhere it has something to say about that. So this book is the size of a dictionary. Big. It's very large.
There's so much lore there. It is very, there's very likely an answer that somebody is yelling at right now.
It's probably
as
true.
They're listening. Yeah. And my apologies. I am not up on my Tolkien lore the same way that many of our listeners are. So I think it's a good question. I just don't know the answer.
L. Joyce says, I've heard people say that The Hobbit is based on Norse mythology, especially the elements of the Finding of the Ring. Isn't this sort of at odds with Tolkien's stated goal to create a mythology for England? Or was it current at the time to accept that many Brits, or at least the Brits at Oxford, had Norse ancestry? Alternately stated, if you were teaching a class on The Hobbit, what would you list as Tolkien's key influences in its creation? Heidi, thoughts on this? I mean, you can answer Norse mythology question.
I think that one of the things for Tolkien that we can't and ought not to discount is just how much he liked it. He just thought it was wonderful. And and he and Lewis both just loved Norse mythology, thought it was deeply underrepresented in the literary tradition, and wanted to bring it back, right? They particularly loved the story of Baldur. They thought it was like the most Christ-like myth in pre-Christian and then early Christian times. They just loved it. And so in creating a world that was in many ways like England, but different, right? They were bringing in some of their favorite stories, probably for some really good academic and cultural reasons, and probably just out of their love for it, right? Like he just thought it was cool and put it into the stories along with fairy tales and myths and all the other things that we've talked about. And in so doing, created this kind of cultural soup that makes up Middle Earth on a literary level and within the story that is much like culture in general, right? Like so much of what we have here is just this kind of like amalgamation of things that stick in culture. And people study that and try to figure out why we still are talking about Achilles, but not really Jason of the Argonauts to the same extent. What makes that story so much more compelling and so much more memorable within a culture? What made it stick, right? And people ask those same questions about Middle Earth because it's such a complete and wonderful culture in itself. And I think with the Norse stuff, a lot of it was just because, honestly, Tolkien thought it was great.
Yeah, I think that's right. I do know that in the Victorian era, there was a huge resurgence in the popularity of Viking culture. Mm-hmm. The British Empire more and more was sort of turning back to the Vikings as this ancient analog or medieval analog of heroism and ingenuity and people who ruled naval empires through naval acumen, and were more and more comfortable associating themselves with the Viking culture as sort of this inheritance of theirs as modern day Britons. And that resulted in a lot of popular fiction that was Viking oriented. But I think Lewis and Tolkien were still, as scholars who were studying Northern European languages and culture, they were still lamenting how little of the forming and informing myth and deeper historical culture hadn't quite come across to the popular level of appreciation. So that's Tolkien's main model then for what he says is his primary goal, which is to create something of a unique myth for Britain, which he felt they still lacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you couldn't really create a mythology that was like truly English without acknowledging the influence of the Scandinavian
Yeah, that's right.
World, I mean, even if you are like super, you know, upset about Lindisfarne, which you should be, you know, the until the Normans came in, that like the acumen of the Vikings was a pretty important part of their history and a pretty big influence. So, you know, as you said, as Heidi said, I think there's a great affection for it. And Sarah says, this is more of a fun hypothetical. Have you run across the fan theory that the Arkan Stone is in fact a Silmaril? There are various versions of the fates of the Silmarils in the Legendarium, but at least one is lost in a chasm of the earth. What if, for a brief moment in time, Bilbo Baggins of the Shire was in possession of both the Ring of Power and a Silmaril? The Wood Elves, who come to the battle, would probably not have recognized it, but Gandalf probably would. So, fan theory, speaking of fun things, either of you want to comment on this fan theory?
Well, I mean, Heidi, I could go for a minute. So
That's what I want. Riff on this.
Okay, so it is a popular theory. My theory is that they're just the same sort of thing. Tolkien, when he began writing this story, did not imagine that the world of the Silmarillion and the world of the Hobbit would totally merge into a single one. So I think this idea of this stone or jewel of great inherent beauty and value that causes conflict is just one that Tolkien cares a lot about, right? It's also kind of an analog to the Ring of Power in the Lord of the Rings, this thing that people lust over and go mad for. And so I don't think that they are necessarily meant to be one and the same, but he never shuts the door on that either.
Is there an objective, like, is there something within the story that kind of holds you back from committing fully to this theory, or is it more of just a sense? Like, how would you?
So one of the important things about what happens to the Silmarils, one, the description of the Arkan Stone is superlative, but it's not quite superlative enough to really convince me that it's a Silmaril. The Silmarils harnessed the light of the two trees of Valinor, which themselves captured the light of the sun and the moon. And so these were brilliant, radiant gems. Think of like the file of Galadriel in the Lord of the Rings. Like, that's a Silmaril. So the Arkan Stone is great, but it's not quite that great. And in the Silmarillion, it's pretty important that the three Silmarils are all sort of beyond the reach of the people of Middle-earth by the end of their story arc. And yes, one is supposed to have fallen deep into the earth, but really, and one into the sea, and then one is taken up into the heavens. And that's important too, that their resting places are kind of in the three realms. It would seem unlikely then that one would be that easy to rediscover and obtain in that way. There's another cool, speaking of dwarves though, there's another cool sort of Silmarillion parallel. The Silmarils harness the light of the two trees of Valinor. The other thing that is supposed to have been imbued with the light of those two trees is the hair of Galadriel, who then gives three strands of her hair to Gimli the dwarf, who says he's going to encase them in precious gems. So there you go. If you want a fun Silmarillion dwarf theory.
I just love Galadriel and Gimli's relationship so much.
Right? That's so great.
That's so just great. So wonderful.
Here's a comment for you, Heidi. This is from Alicia. She says, no question. I just want to say that I'm also proud of myself for reading this. I've tried to read both The Hobbit and The Lord of the Ring and The Fellowship of the Ring in the past and struggled and quit. The Lord of the Ring movies came out when I was in high school and I wasn't familiar with the stories and then didn't care to spend hours of my time watching them. I'm not a huge fantasy genre fan, etc., but I enjoy the Close Reads podcast so much that I challenged myself to read The Hobbit. I'm almost 40 after all. I can hang with a tough book. I read The Road for Pete's sake, and I found The Hobbit wonderful. It was a great ride. I appreciated Bilbo's courage, but also his mental softness and his desire to return home. I read portions of it out loud to my kids, and they were really interested. We may start to read it to them. They're 6 and 9. When they got to the forest, I told her that Gandalf told them to stay on the path. And I asked her what she thought that Bilbo and the dwarves did. She said, they went off the path. What happened? Spiders, daughter. Spiders. That is what happened. Thanks again. So that's for you, Heidi.
I love that because I think that my experience with Lord of the Rings was relatively similar. This is my confession. All right. I will gladly receive your scorn for what I'm about to say, listeners. I'm cool with that. I have never understood the reader's affection for the Fellowship. I feel like it doesn't start until they get to Rivendell and then go on the quest. Like, it is the second two books that appeal to me more. And I have come to appreciate it and to see people's love for it. But I just always have this sense of like, when are they going to begin their quest? And then they... Like, I am all in, 100% in when, like, the minute that it hooks me, and I read it every year because I teach these books every year, it always hooks me. Like, the moment of my investment in the story of Lord of the Rings is when when Frodo says, I will take the ring, I do not know the way. That is the moment that I'm like, I'm all in on this story. Until then, I feel like it's a long lead up to the story. And I know I'm wrong about that, but I say that to like, I think sometimes for women, it's a little bit harder because these archetypes are not feminine archetypes. Like men tend to have this tend to be more of like a heart book from it. And I realize I'm being too general and that there's lots and lots of people who don't feel the same way, but I think that there's enough women who read this and it's not a failure on Tolkien's part. He's allowed to put whatever characters he wants. There's almost all men because this is more of a masculine story. That's fine. Like, that's great. He doesn't have to do anything because he couldn't foresee this cultural moment that demands strong female characters, or else it's a literary flaw. That is not Tolkien's problem. That's ours, right? The conflicts in the story, the characters in the story are so masculine that I have a hard time like having it be a heart book, right? Until Weathertop. And then I'm like all in on Frodo and his torment. I'm all about those tormented characters, as you know. So I say this not because it's a flaw, but because I relate in some ways to it just taking longer for this book to take root in me.
Sean, these things are always abrupt, so I'm just going to go on to the next question because we got a couple we got to get through here. So this transition, Heidi, is not to suggest that what you were saying is not compelling, but rather just to suggest that we have a couple more questions we need to get to. So
no, I think Heidi made a really important point in that it's you have to read to at least the Council of Elrond before you give up the Fellowship.
Yeah, you know, people come into the shop all the time and they tell me that they quit reading it because there's like in chapter two or something.
Oh no.
Or they tell me they quit when they get to Bombadil and Goldberry's house, and then I just get my feelings hurt. Okay, so
that's the worst part.
Okay, so Jennifer says the elves seemed so different than the Lord of the Rings elves across the board. The silly songs and la la la. I just couldn't reconcile with Elrond, Rivendell, and how serious the elves are in the trilogy. Since they're immortal, it seems weird for them to change so much in only 100 years or whatever the gap in Bilbo and Frodo starting their respective journeys. Does anyone else find this difference jarring? Sean, what do you think about this one?
Yes. I think that I do find it jarring. I think that you could console yourself by saying, well, on the meta level, we've talked about it already, but when he first wrote this story, he didn't know how much of that world it would share in. On another level, the elves are totally different. They're not just men who live a really long time. It's really helpful to think of the elves in the broader elven category in some degree, like the fairy folk who are different and kind of wily and whimsical. And in The Hobbit, the elves and even Elrond and his folk don't have the same problems that they do in The Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's only a few decades prior to those events, but you know, Sauron isn't making a ruckus yet. And things don't seem as the One Ring hasn't resurfaced, and Elrond's daughter isn't being courted by some long-haired bad boy from the woods. So he might just be a more chipper, happy-go-lucky guy at that point.
I think that Tolkien is trying to address this problem or this dissonance. I think he acknowledges, I don't know if it's a problem, but a little bit of dissonance with when The Lord of the Rings gets so much more weighty than The Hobbit. As an author, he seems to be trying to address this with the distinction between the Lothlorien elves and the Rivendell elves, and by extension, then the Mirkwood elves.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Mm-hmm. That there is a distinction within these elven cultures. And so I think he's aware, he knows that he's adding so much more, not only to the story, into the world building, into the lore and all that, to the legendarium, but also the gravitas, the emotional weight of the story is there. There's not a mediating story in between, right? There is The Hobbit, and then there is The Lord of the Rings, and the Silmarillion is another thing altogether, right? And there's some short stories in there too, that I think he's kind of trying to give us then a body of work coming from Middle Earth, that, and within a body of work, we're allowed to have different kind of emotional weights and stakes within these stories and different narrative tones and voices and all of these things. And so I think that he's trying intentionally to address some of those dissonances. And then, of course, we're left to say, how successful we think he was at it.
I mean, he even went back and tried to tweak some things in The Hobbit in a future edition and all that. So,
yeah.
I mean, this should be a lesson to you. Don't try to tell a big multi-part epic story across your life that has all kinds of characters and people that are going to evolve and change in your mind. I mean, just don't do that.
Why? Because it won't be as good as Lord of the Rings. Later being like,
Exactly.
I mean, he tried to get out of it too. The publisher said, The Hobbit was great. What else you got? And he said, how about the Silmarillion? And they read it and said, how about something else?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, last question here from Kat. I'd like to hear more about Bjorn. I think of him like an animagus, able to choose when to be a person and when to be a bear. But my husband thinks he's more like a werewolf, that perhaps he's not fully in control of himself or his transformations. I think he's a good guy, but also feel like that may be too black and white of a perspective. He seems a little wild and unpredictable. Perhaps he's not a tame bear.
She says.
Heidi, thoughts on Bjorn? Speaking of Norse mythology.
I like this question a lot because these characters, like Tom Bombadil, there's a couple of characters here that are just remain mysterious, and Tolkien does a masterful job of kind of giving us these characters and then just leaving them to us and not interpreting them, right? Like, and Tom Bombadil is another one of those. But with Bjorn, he is, I really like that. Like, he is not safe, not tame, but good. I think that Aslan descriptor, taken in a different context, actually works for him. I interpreted more like the animagus that can shape shift at will. But I like that idea that he can't, that he is kind of bound by some kind of magic. But I'd never thought of that before. So I just thought that comment was illuminating. And maybe this is addressed somewhere else in the Legendarian, but again, I haven't read every single thing. So Sean, correct. Yeah. Bring it home.
I really like that idea. Right. It's and the scene where they spend the night in his house is so great because there's that tension that this good guy who has already shown himself to be hospitable, he's given them a warm place to sleep, and he's given them food, yet it remains a danger to them. I think that's such a great sort of dramatic tension in that scene. I like the idea that maybe there's something outside of his control. Maybe it's emotional, even. Like when he gets really angry, it seems his transformation is more extreme. Right, he's a massive giant bear in the final battle. There is this story that Tolkien is sort of working from of a Viking king or chieftain who is supposed to take part in this massive battle, and his troops are outnumbered, but then suddenly a giant bear appears on the battlefield and starts
killing. Goes back to the derivation of the word berserk.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. The to wear the coat of the bear, right, is to be a berserker, to take on the spirit of the bear. This bear appears on the battlefield and starts killing their enemies, and they're excited because the tide is turning. But then they look around and they can't find their chieftain anywhere. And someone goes back to the camp and into his tent, and he's there asleep. And they shake him awake and say, you gotta come see this. But the moment he's awoken, the bear vanishes. And so the idea is that he is the bear, but he and the bear can't both be in the same place at the same time. But it's a little more, the relationship in the source story is a little more mystical.
This is also a really common trope in, or a common characteristic of characters in the, in medieval stories, whether human or not, because the medievals really fully embrace this kind of in-between world, right? This, yeah. that the natural world, in medieval times was not some kind of repository of natural resources that could be dominated by man and then brought into submission to make, you know, technology or build things, right? But it was overwhelming. It was scary, right? And they didn't have control over it. And so they had so many characters that kind of inhabit their imaginary world that are, you know, unicorns are not... They're really dangerous in medieval stories. Yeah. They could only be tamed by a young woman virgin, right? You know, we have this kind of safetyism, which is a term I just learned from Jonathan Haidt's new book, The Anxious Generation. he calls it an obsession or elevation of safety as like the highest priority, right? And we do that even in stories today when we put things in categories like that, that there's kind of no in between there. And the best characters are the safest characters, the characters who bring safety, right? And Bjorn doesn't bring safety, he brings protection. Protection from a dangerous world that they have to re-enter, and he is a part of, right? And he's a more of a guardian against an even wilder darkness. But he is a part of that wild world. He's just kind of the friendliest of the unfriendly, so to speak, right? And I think that that's really important. In understanding medieval stories, and I think there's kind of a lack of that in stories today, which makes them a little bit vanilla, which is kind of a bummer.
Yeah.
I imagine Bjorn and Tom Bombadil, like they have some kind of, they're like part of a council in the woods. And every now and then, you know, like they read the Council of Rivendell, you know, these guys get together, or the wizards get together, but also these woodland dwellers, these basically magical dwellers, they get together and they talk about the state of affairs outside the world. And Tom's like, I'm just going to hang out here in my haven. And Bjorn's like, and I'm going to fight. And they have like their own approaches. And, you know, they're like of the same general spirit, but different personality types. They're different numbers on the Enneagram.
That's right. And the Ents sort of fit into that category a little bit.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, the Ents. Yeah. But the Ents probably frustrate Bjorn a lot because he's like he's a man of action, right?
Right.
And by the time they've spoken, he'll have changed into a bear and back again a few times. So therefore, it's really the Ents are getting annoyed by Bombadil and Bjorn more than anything. Yeah. Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our conversations on The Hobbit. Thanks to everyone who sent in questions. Any final thoughts from either of you? Sean, you go first.
I had seen some comments regarding this, so I would just reiterate that Close Reads has done on the bonus show a long read through of the Lord of the Rings trilogy. So people who are asking about whether that is a possibility, that it already exists and you can binge listen to it tonight.
That's true. If you want. I don't know if you could get through it all in one night. Heidi, any final thoughts from you? Thanks for pointing that out, Sean.
1.4 speed.
Oh man, that's cool. So stressful.
Especially the way
I can't do higher than 1.2. Otherwise my mind's like, ah! No, I do not have any final thoughts other than this was just such a fun. I'm so
what
glad
a blast.
We did it. Yes.
Let's start over.
Yeah.
So up next, we have Trust by Hernan Diaz. Tim will be back. And Sean, are you joining us too? Are all four of us doing that one?
I'm a quarter of the way in and I'm hooked.
All right, great. So we're going to talk about part one. That book is divided into four parts and we will talk about one part on each episode. So part one on the first episode and part two on the second episode and so on and so forth. Followed at the end by Q&A. I know, right? It's almost like he wrote the book in the structure that makes it easiest to talk about on a podcast. For those who are waiting, following that, we will be doing the summer book. And that will take us into the summer. We've got all the other stuff I talked about at the top of the show, Kristen Lovren's daughter and the Daily Poem and the mystery story, and which is Josephine Tay's The Franchise Affair. Just a quick note, if you thought it was going to be Double Indemnity, we're pushing that one because it doesn't really suit the project of that evolved this year on that series.
But we'll come back to it.
We will. I think
we're
that's about
it. We changed our minds.
Yeah, we reserve the right. But truly, thanks to everyone who sent in questions, everyone who talked to their children about The Hobbit, and everyone who just reads good books with their kids.
You're the real champions. That's right. You're the heroes.
All right. Well, for Heidi White and for Sean Johnson, I'm David Kern. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, happy reading.